Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, November 20th. I am Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with today's mini editorial, which is from the Journal Editorial Board. And they write, Santa is coming to downtown Sioux City Monday night. Don't miss the largest parade in downtown for the holiday's history. And we'll do an overview for the five-day forecast coming up in Siouxland. Today is going to be a little milder than it has been in the past few days, with plenty of sunshine, a predicted high of 46 and a low of 22 tonight. Monday there will be plenty of sun with a high of 40 and a low of 19. Tuesday will be partly sunny and with a high of 48 and a low of 21. Wednesday will be mild with more sunshine than clouds, with a high of 53 and a low of 30. And then Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, is going to become a little bit cooler and it'll be some more wind. And the high will be 44 and the low of 26. The top story on the front page, it has a headline of Legislature Interest Groups Prepare for Renewed Private School Scholarship Push. Legislation addressing taxpayer-funded private school scholarships is likely to make a comeback in the next Iowa legislative session. Proponents of the policy say they hope to see an expanded version of what was passed in the Iowa Senate during this year's session. Senate Republicans passed a bill that would have made up to 10,000 scholarships available to students to attend private schools or charter schools. The scholarships would have been available to families making up to 400% of the federal poverty line and students with an individual education program, or IEP, generally students with disabilities or special needs. The proposal would have seen around $55 million diverted from public schools to fund those scholarships, according to estimates from the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Proponents of the policy say it gives parents more choice over their children's education and would help students who don't succeed at public schools, while opponents argue it would hurt public schools. Keeping taxpayer dollars in public schools would help the largest number of children. The measure failed to pass in the last legislative session in the House, where around a dozen Republicans did not support it. Many in rural districts who were concerned about the policy's effects on schools in their area. Democrats in both chambers opposed the measure. The bill was one of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' flagship policy proposals during the last session, and she campaigned this year on bringing a similar measure back in the next session. A spokesperson for Reynolds said she will reveal her legislative priorities in her annual Condition of the State address once the legislative session starts, and she will never give up on providing children with the best learning environment they deserve. The legislative session will start January 9, 2023. House Republicans will create a new Education Reform Committee in the upcoming session, which will deal with bills containing significant reforms to our education system, according to a press release. Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley of New Hartford, who will chair the committee, did not say whether it would consider a private school scholarship bill. The House Republican caucus plans to consider a broad set of education reforms this session, he said in a statement. This new committee will allow these important issues to be put in front of the entire caucus for the in-depth discussions they deserve. Both chambers also passed bills during this last year's session dealing with transparency in education, which would require schools to publish course materials and lesson plans online. But the legislation stalled amid disagreement over the private school scholarship proposal. In the Senate, where the proposal has passed the last 2 years with less dissent among Republicans, Majority Leader Jack Whitford said it's too early to know exactly what will be in a Senate bill dealing with private school tuition assistance. I expect to debate policies similar to the bills Senate Republicans passed in the 2021 and 2022 sessions, allowing parents to use scholarships to send their children to the school that best fits their needs, he said in a statement. Democrats are expected to oppose those measures if they come up. Iowans don't care if a new committee in the Iowa legislature is created to consider the governor's voucher plan or other bad ideas like jailing teachers and banning books, because it's just all politics, House Minority Leader Jennifer Kahn of Windsor Heights said in a statement this week, House Democrats stand alongside Iowans and will oppose any bill that shifts money from public schools to private schools. It's time to put people over politics. Advocates for the policy said their gold standard is to see a system where any family can use the funds that would go to a child's public school for private schooling or homeschooling rather than a limited number that was proposed in the last session. While Iowa Republicans may not go that far this year, advocates said they expect to see a proposal that will expand on what the Senate Republicans passed this year. If I were going to guess, and I haven't seen a bill, it'd be more than $10,000, Chuck Hurley, Vice President and Chief Counsel for the conservative Christian organization, The Family Leader, said. It'd be pretty expensive because I think the governor is really on a mission to try to help more parents. Trish Rilger, Executive Director of the Iowa Advocates for Choice in Education, said the formation of the Education Reform Committee in the House was a sign that House Republicans will make progress on the issue. We are not certain of the intent for that committee or how education and education reform will work together, but we are optimistic that it means the House is very serious about education issues, including school choice, she said. But not everyone is expecting an expansion of the measure. Margaret Buckton, a lobbyist for the Rural Education Advocates of Iowa and the Urban Education Network, both of which oppose the scholarship bill, said she would be surprised to see a proposal larger than what the Senate passed in the last session. Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, the union that represents teachers and educators in Iowa, declined a request for an interview because specific legislation has not been proposed. But in an emailed statement, he said the ISEA would continue to oppose diverting public school dollars to private schools. Iowa's public schools continue to heroically serve their communities, students, and families, and public dollars need to go to public education, he said. Spending vital taxpayer money on private school vouchers when our public schools needs resources to address the needs of the nearly 500,000 students attending them is harmful to Iowans in every community across the state. Opponents of the idea say public opinion is on their side. In an exit poll conducted by Public Policy Polling for the liberal advocacy group Progress Iowa, 54% of the respondents who voted in the November midterm said they think public tax dollars should go toward public schools only, while 39% said some students should be able to use the dollars for non-public schools. With a new class of Republican legislators, it remains to be seen whether there will be enough support in the House of Representatives to pass the legislation. Reynolds threw her support behind primary challengers to 9 House Republicans that did not support the measure in this year's primary election, and several of those incumbents lost in the primary. Notably, Representative Dustin Height, Republican from New Sharon, who chaired the Education Committee and opposed the measure, lost his bid for re-election to primary challenger Helena Hayes. There have been some changes in who's in the seats in the Republican majority. The Republicans have a larger majority as well, Wilger said. And we believe that school choice supporters are among the new faces in the House, so we are optimistic. On the other side, Buckton said she's optimistic opponents can convince legislatures of the harmful effects they say private school tuition assistance would have on public schools in Iowa. When you get to actually looking at policies and hearing from constituents about their feelings about it, she said, I think it's not going to be a done deal at all. I think there will be a lot of good quality conversation. Our next story headline is Community College Enrollment Increases for First Time in 12 Years. Enrollment in Iowa Community College has grown for the first time since 2010. One of the largest areas of growth was in career and technical programs. Northwest Iowa Community College in Sheldon followed this trend, reporting both enrollment growth and the largest welding class in the school's history. Nationally, community college enrollment continues to decrease, reporting a 0.4% drop in enrollment this far. The annual Iowa fall enrollment report showed the number of community college students climbed by 0.6%. Total community college enrollments are 82,251 this fall. Iowa Community College enrollment peaked in 2010 at 106,596, but enrollment has been dropping since. Of the 15 community colleges in Iowa, 7 reported enrollment growth. In Siouxland, Northwest Iowa Community College reported an enrollment increase of 5.4%, resulting in the largest fall class in its history and the largest enrollment of students in the welding program. Western Iowa Tech Community College reported a decrease of 5.5%. A majority of the students enrolled in Iowa community colleges are part-time. Since 2010, full-time enrollment has been falling, while part-time enrollment has steadily increased, with this year hitting an all-time record of 65.9% of total enrollment, according to the report. NCC reported 1,798 students this fall. 69% are part-time students. NCC had a record enrollment in the welding program. There are 25 full-time students and 8 local high school students taking the course. In the state, career and technical programs increased by 3.2%, comprising of 28.6% of community college students, according to the IDE. Robert Hodane has been the instructor with NCC's welding program for 25 years. He started with one student and has seen the program grow and change over the years. Hodane believes the recent spike in enrollment is due to awareness of the new welding lab, which NCC renovated in 2019, as well as the wide coverage the program offers regarding welding. It's not just one process or another, Hodane says. We cover a little bit of stick welding, shielded metal welding, gas metal arc welding, gas tungsten arc welding, and they get a flavor of all the process so they can get a pretty good idea of where they want to go in their career. In the years he has taught, Hodane has seen huge progress in welding machinery and the industry as a whole. He tries to make sure the coursework keeps up with the industry needs and the current equipment. The course is less bookwork and more hands-on learning with real-world experiences. Welding professionals are in high demand throughout the nation. Hodane said every person has interacted with welded items, from vehicles to bed frames, and there are not enough students entering the field to meet the demand. Hodane said most of his students will have employment secured before graduation, and he frequently receives calls from area industry asking for him to send welders their way. Nationally, the American Welding Society predicts that 336,000 new welding professionals will be needed by 2026, with around 84,000 needed every year. Jacob Foster and Bryce Olson are two of the students taking NCC's welding course. Olson is a freshman at NCC, and Foster is a junior at Sheldon High School taking NCC welding courses in the mornings and finishing high school in the afternoons. Both have had previous experience in welding and knew that was the career field they wanted to follow. Foster and Olson said they had heard good things about NCC's welding program and Hodane's teaching. It's a really good atmosphere, Foster said. While community college enrollment is dropping, four-year college and university enrollments have been increasing, according to the American Association of Community Colleges. Olson and Foster said they believe parents are encouraging students to seek out four-year degrees instead of looking at community college offerings. Foster said he would not want to attend a four-year university, both because of the size and cost. Olson said he likes the interpersonal relationships that community colleges provide. We're not just a number, he said. They're here to help us with each and every aspect. Changes to Parade Magazine. Parade Magazine, which has been inserted into newspapers across the nation for decades, recently discontinued its print publication and has moved exclusively to an e-edition product. Its final print edition was published last Sunday in the Sioux City Journal. Of course, all print and digital subscribers of the journal still have access to Parade's weekly electronic magazine on the journal's e-edition platforms, but there's more to the story. Starting with today's print edition, the journal is proud to offer a new weekly print edition page that will include some of the Parade's best content, the same content you've loved for years. Not only does the new offering include Parade's cover story for the week, it also includes a fun and challenging numerical puzzle called Numbrix. This enhanced content partnership between the journal and Parade is meant to ensure that you, our loyal readers, continue to receive the best that Parade has to offer inside our printed newspaper, as well as within our e-edition products every week. Thank you for supporting local journalism by way of your subscription to the journal. We hope you enjoy the new Parade page, as well as the new Parade e-edition magazine. Today's featured donor for the Good Fellow Charity, which raises money to provide toys and books for Siouxland children during the holidays, is Meyer Brothers Funeral Homes, and their donation amount was $1,000. Meyer Brothers Funeral Homes have served the Siouxland community for over 60 years. Meyer Brothers operates 5 locations in Sioux City, South Sioux City, and Ponca, Nebraska, offering caring and compassionate service to families in their time of need. Families can choose funeral services, memorial and cremation services, pre-planned services, cemetery markers, monuments, and aftercare. Both the Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel and the Moore and Becker Hunt Chapel offer luncheon areas that accommodate up to 100 guests. And they are, again, the featured donor for the Good Fellow Charity. We'll now continue with some more election results. Republican concedes to Democrat Rob Sand in state auditor's race. Iowa still will have one statewide Democrat in office after Republican state auditor candidate Todd Helberg conceded the race Friday to Democratic incumbent auditor Rob Sand. Helber said he was dropping his request for a recount because he did not have sufficient resources to file the request in all 99 counties, and he claimed the Republican Party of Iowa would not help support a statewide recount. Sand led the race by 2,893 votes out of nearly 1.2 million cast in the election, a margin of just 0.24%, according to the latest unofficial results reported by the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Because the victory margin is less than 1%, Helber, by state law, could request a recount without being required to post a bond, with Iowa counties picking up the cost. Helber, though, would still have to physically file paperwork with each county auditor in the state within 3 days after the county canvass and recruit designees in all 99 counties to serve on recount boards. They have to have the flexibility to do a hand count for days and be flexible for 18 total days to get the recount done, Helber said in a statement. My campaign does not have the staff or infrastructure to get that coordinated on a statewide basis in that short amount of time. Each county just oversees the ballots for the recount board that my campaign has to put together to do the recount. Sand is the only Iowa Democrat to win a statewide race in the November 8th midterm election. Iowa Republicans won the campaigns for U.S. Senate, Governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, Secretary of Agriculture, and State Treasurer, ousting 2 40-year Democratic incumbents. Republicans defeated the longest-serving State Attorney General, Democrat Tom Miller, and the longest-serving State Treasurer, Democrat Mike Fitzgerald, in U.S. history. Sand on Twitter said he and Helber had a kind and cordial conversation in which Helber conceded the race. Back to work, Iowa. Let's do this, Sand tweeted. Sand, a lawyer, served in the Iowa Attorney General's office from 2010 to 2017 as a prosecutor of public corruption cases before being elected state auditor in 2018. The office is responsible for auditing the financial operations of Iowa state and local governments and provides guidance to CPA firms performing such audits. In his first term, Sand said his office identified more than $25 million in misspent funds and created an efficiency program to help public entities find new ways to save money. Republicans have accused Sand of using the auditor's office for partisan attacks, pointing to audits focused on Governor Kim Reynolds. One audit led to Reynolds returning $21 million in COVID-19 aid that was improperly spent. Another audit alleged the Republican governor improperly promoted herself in a taxpayer-funded public awareness campaign during the pandemic, a claim the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board rejected. Sand has said he manages his office in a nonpartisan manner, appointing a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat to his senior leadership team, and also led investigations to cast the Reynolds administration in a favorable light, like one showing officials had accurately reported COVID-19 data in the first year of the pandemic. Helber owns a school supply distribution company and is a licensed real estate agent in Clive. He also served as chief financial officer at the Iowa Alcohol Beverages Division, which dismissed him in 2018. He was recently awarded $1 million by a Polk County juror as a result of a whistleblower lawsuit against the division and its administrator for wrongful termination. Helber said he was fired after raising questions about excessive price markups and payments made under an improper no-bid contract. Helber became the Republican nominee for auditor by narrowly defeating former State Representative Marianne Hanusa in the June primary. Hanusa was endorsed by Governor Kemp Reynolds and other Republican leaders. After defeating her, Helber raised little money during the race, less than $50,000, and state Republicans did not put resources behind his campaign, leaving him vastly outspent by Sand, who spent more than $1.8 million in the statewide contest. In a statement to the Gazette and a post on Facebook, Helber said the Republican Party of Iowa failed to provide any support and resources to my campaign for a statewide recount. This leaves me with no other option than to abandon this recount effort, just as the state GOP organization has abandoned my campaign, Helber wrote. He thanked family, friends, volunteers, and voters whose support demonstrated that a hardworking, non-career politician can be a viable candidate in a statewide race. Colin Crompton, communications director for the Republican Party of Iowa, pointed to the party's efforts to help candidates up and down the ballot this year, providing hundreds of thousands of dollars and coordinated hours of grassroots manpower. At the same time, successful candidates knock doors, attend events, talk to voters, and raise money, Crompton said in a statement. Hardworking candidates win elections. We are proud of the work our team put in this year and look forward to defeating Rob Sand in his next election. Zach Wall, Sarah Trone-Garrett elected to lead Iowa Senate Democrats. Iowa Senate Democrats re-elected Senator Zach Walls to serve as Senate Minority Leader and elected Senator Sarah Trone-Garrett to serve as Minority Whip for the upcoming legislative session. I'm honored by the trust my fellow Democrats have placed in me as we fight for middle-class families, Walls said in a press release. Walls of Coralville was first elected to the Senate in 2018 and named the chamber's Democratic leader in 2020. He is a vice president and Greed State Credit Union. Trone-Garrett of West Des Moines was first elected in 2020 and was elected again this year after redistricting, defeating Republican Senate President Jake Chapman. She is a Lutheran minister and coordinator of interfaith engagement for the Des Moines Area Religious Council Food Pantry Network. Trone-Garrett is succeeding Amanda Reagan of Mason City as Minority Whip, who retired this year after 20 years in the Iowa Senate. Iowa voters did not give Republicans a mandate to sell out the middle class, wreck public schools, and strip away basic rights, Trone-Garrett said in the press release. Senate Democrats will stand up to Republican overreach and give Iowa families a voice in our government. The caucus elected Nate Bolton, Des Moines, Eric Giddens, Cedar Falls, Pam Yoakum, Dubuque, and Herman Quernbach, Ames to serve as assistant leaders. House Democrats reelected Jennifer Confrist of Windsor Heights to serve as Minority Leader and Lindsey James of Dubuque to serve as Minority Whip in the House last weekend. Democrats lost seats in both chambers of the legislature after November's election. They are slated to hold 16 seats in the Senate, while Republicans will hold 34. With two-thirds of the chamber, Republicans will be able to prevent Democrats from blocking gubernatorial appointees that require a two-thirds majority. Wall said in the release, Senate Democrats will continue to defend economic opportunity and fundamental rights. Republican politicians, meanwhile, are offering the same old extreme and unfair agenda, rewarding big corporations over middle-class families and attacking Iowans' personal freedom, he said. Republicans elected their leadership last week, shortly following the midterm election. Jack Whitfer of Grimes was reelected as Senate Majority Leader, while Amy Sinclair of Allerton was elected Senate President, succeeding Chapman. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we'll begin with the journal editorial. And it's headlined, Our Opinion, Put Politics Aside and Think of All That's Good. We barely got a week to exhale, and the quest for the White House began. Former President Donald Trump announced his third run for the job and taunted Florida Governor Ron DeSantis about his potential announcement. Mike Pence hit the network news shows and suggested he was simply pushing a new book. Mitt Romney called for new party leadership. In less than a week, you could feel it starting. Even a hardcore political junkie knows there's a need to put this train on hold and let voters think about something other than politics. As we enter the week of Thanksgiving, we need to embrace the strides we've made in the last year. COVID, which kept us sequestered from friends and family, isn't as threatening as it once was. Jobs are plentiful, so plentiful there aren't enough workers to fill them. Schools are open and students are once again engaging in activities that help define their futures. Families are ready to gather, proving certain holidays are memory makers, ones children can look back on with fondness. Taylor Swift is selling more tickets than anyone thought possible. Elon Musk is experiencing the kinds of problems non-billionaires see every day, and Hallmark is making nighttime television something other than a repository for political commercials and reality shows. Now, we have a request for you. Think of those things that do seem right in the world. Focus on them and try to get back to where you were before everything appeared to go off the rails. A better world is possible, but it begins with us looking up from our cell phones and realizing what it is we have. It's a time for giving thanks. There are reasons, good ones, and our list begins with you. We'll now move to the letters to the editor, and the first one is written by Shirley Stoll of Primgar, Iowa. And Shirley writes, $7.6 billion was spent on political ads just during this 2022 political cycle. I personally think that is a huge waste of money. I did not put any stock in those negative ads and feel lots of others did not either. Better to just spend some on sensible debates like those done on Iowa Public TV. And again, this was written by Shirley Stoll of Primgar. And then our next letter is written by Dean Bradham of Sioux City. And Dean writes, I applaud the November 10th column, Apprentices Show Their Worth in a Changing World, by Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend. We are right to highlight the importance and success of registered apprenticeship programs in this state. However, the director's article fails to mention one critical stakeholder that is largely responsible for perfecting the apprenticeship model, labor unions. In particular, the building trades unions in this state have set the standard for the earn while you learn model, which has been replicated by other industries in recent years. It is short-sighted not to credit the hard work done by unions and their affiliated training programs to advance apprenticeships here in Iowa. The reality is that the outcomes in union apprenticeships often exceed those of other programs. According to a 2021 research study conducted by the nonpartisan Midwest Economic Policy Institute, Iowa's union apprenticeship programs are leading in diversity and showing higher success rates all around compared to non-union and employer-only programs, especially for women. Their report, Apprenticeship Training in Iowa, Enrollment, Completion Rates, and Earnings, found that women are significantly more likely to complete their programs in a union apprenticeship compared to a non-union apprenticeship. The report also notes that union apprenticeship programs account for 70% of the state's apprentices who are women. Once again, I applaud that Iowa recognizes the value of registered apprenticeships, but the state's building trade unions have been the model for well over 100 years. Do not forget about us. Again, this was written by Dean Bradham of Sioux City. We'll now move to a column by one of the Sioux City Journal's regulars, and today's is written by Susan Stewart, who is a retired corporate attorney. During the 40 years she has lived in Sioux City, she has been involved in a variety of local and state volunteer activities, including serving as chair of the Woodbury County Republican Party. She and her husband, Dr. Bob Stewart, are the parents of 4 children and have 5 grandchildren. And today she writes, the headline on it is Role Model Reminds Us of the Help We Could Give. In today's column, I want to tell the story of one man whose dogged determination made a difference for our country and also for my family. Like all Boy Scouts, Steve Reary liked to hike. Starting in 1972, he climbed Mount Charleston, about an hour outside of Las Vegas. The top of the mountain was riddled with plane crash debris. He learned that there had been a fatal crash in 1955. He tried to learn more. It was not until 1998 that he learned the CIA accident report had been declassified. The report described the November 17, 1955 crash of USAF Flight 9068, bound from Burbank, California for Watertown, Nevada, now known as Area 51. All 14 passengers perished. The passengers were on their way to test the U-2 spy plane, a key American intelligence resource. Radio could not be used because of the fear of Soviet interception. An early winter snowstorm developed. The pilot became disoriented. Eventually, the plane drifted off course and impacted dead center of the highest point in the Spring Mountain Range, which was Mount Charleston. The plane hit the mountain in a fiery crash. The Air Force sought to quickly secure the classified site. A brave team of Las Vegas Mountie Posse and their horses also set off to rescue the travelers. They made their way through snowdrifts and determined there was no survivors. The bodies were removed, but due to secrecy concerns, residue from the crash remained on the mountain. From the report, Steve learned the names of the 14 deceased passengers and made contact with all of their families. One passenger was my uncle, Richard J. Ruda. Richard was a young engineer with Lockheed Aircraft Corporation in its Skunk Works division, where he was involved in the design of the U-2. He lived in Burbank with his wife and three children. Steve learned that the catastrophe had been cloaked in secrecy, even for the families. Most details about the crash were highly sensitive and classified. It could not be released. I think that not knowing what had happened to her firstborn broke my Grandma Huda's heart. As a child, I was told that Uncle Richard was a gifted engineer who had died in some sort of plane crash while on a business trip. Many of the families had been unable to learn anything about what had happened to their loved ones, despite repeated efforts. The families had to be relieved to finally learn that the men had died instantly without pain. This was not the last thing Steve did. He sponsored a hike for the families to the crash site in August 2001, which brought closure. He worked with state officials and Nevada Senator Harry Reid to designate the site as a national memorial. In 2015, the Silent Heroes National Memorial site was dedicated as a memorial for those fallen heroes for whom their sacrifice was purposely erased to satisfy the security of our nation. The memorial has a Facebook page, Silent Heroes of the Cold War, where you can see the site, including the twisted propeller from Flight 9068, as a stark reminder of the tragedy. The Silent Heroes continue to be remembered each November 17th, the anniversary of the crash. You may wonder what this inspiring story has to do with Siouxland. Many Siouxlanders travel to Las Vegas, and a side trip to the memorial is certainly a good reminder of an important chapter of our American history. But also, this is a story about what one person can do to make a difference. I contacted Steve, and he is very modest about his accomplishments and the credit I give to him for helping the families of crash victims. But I know that he exemplifies many people in Siouxland who want to help others or solve a community problem and don't give up until they achieve their goal. Are you like Steve Reary? And again, this was written by Susan Stewart. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, November 20th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now go to today's obituaries. Robert Paul Rob Saylor, 59, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, November 5th at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. He spent the last bits of his life surrounded by family and friends and doing what he loved most, loving them unconditionally. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church with Father Peter Nugent officiating. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Please join us to help celebrate this wonderful life that was taken from us far too young. Rob was born April 3, 1963 in Sioux City, the son of Lawrence and Margaret Duman Saylor. He graduated from Bishop Heelan in 1981. Rob was a talented restoration specialist. He was certainly a master of his craft. He restored many buildings and churches in Sioux City and the surrounding areas, including the Orpheum, Blessed Sacrament Church, St. Boniface Church, St. Joseph Church, Salix, St. Cecilia Cathedral, Omaha, and many more. This made Rob a very cherished member of the Catholic community. Rob always strived to learn more and obtain the most information possible. He was always reading books and watching lectures. With his knowledge, he was unstoppable. He enjoyed listening to music, fishing, and baking, but his greatest love was his family and spending as much time as he could with them. Rob was like the moon, always full, even if you didn't see it, a light in the darkest of times. He was a very free spirit and did not need many things to be content. As long as he had his work, his faith, and his family, he was always able to show his admiration. He will be missed until the end of time. Bessie Clamadius, 98, of Whiting, and formerly of Sioux City, passed away peacefully in her sleep on Wednesday, November 9th, at her daughter's home in St. Petersburg. Services will be 10 a.m. on Tuesday at the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in Sioux City. Burial will be at Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be from 6 to 7 p.m. on Monday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. A Trisagion service, I'm not sure how to say that, is spelled T-R-I-S-A-G-I-O-N, service will follow at 7 p.m. Bessie was born March 19, 1924, in Sioux City. When Bessie was 2 years old, her father passed away. After his passing, Bessie, her mother, and her brother moved to Greece. Shortly thereafter, her mother passed away, and Bessie and her brother grew up in an orphanage. In 1941, Bessie married Constantine Klimiadis in Greece. Bessie returned to the United States in 1946, arriving in Minneapolis. She later moved to the South Bottoms neighborhood of Sioux City, where she was a homemaker and raised her five children. Gus passed away in August of 1991. Bessie was a longtime member of Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in Sioux City. She and Gus enjoyed fishing, traveling, and spending the winter months in Florida. In lieu of flowers, the memorials may be directed to Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church, St. Thomas Orthodox Church, or to the family of Bessie Clamadis. Elizabeth Betty Hansen of Kingsley passed away peacefully on November 11th at the age of 88. Services will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday at Road Funeral Home. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit roadfh.com. Betty was born August 18, 1934, to William and Leona Seeky Frank in Stanton, Nebraska. She graduated from Stanton High School in 1952. She attended Nebraska Methodist Hospital Nursing Program and received an RN degree in 1955. Betty married Lauren Ray Hansen, a classmate at Stanton High, on October 21, 1953. In September of 1955, Lauren and Betty moved to Ames, Iowa, where Lauren attended Iowa State University School of Veterinary Medicine. Lauren received his DVM in 1962. While living in Ames, Betty enjoyed being a labor and delivery nurse at Mary Greenlee Medical Center and also worked at the McFarland Clinic in Ames. During the 7 years in Ames, three children were born: Lori Beth in 1956, Julie Lynn in 1957, and Michael Bruce in 1961. The family moved to Kingsley in June of 1962, where Lauren, Doc, practiced veterinary medicine while Betty worked as office manager and veterinary assistant. Betty was a classic giver, always placing the wants and needs of others before her own. She had an extremely generous spirit and was happiest when making others happy. She loved to travel and to spend time with her children and grandchildren. She was also an outstanding cook and an excellent card player. But most of all, Betty was a wonderful and loving wife, mother, and friend. Betty was an active member of the United Church of Christ, where she played piano, organ, and sang in the choir for many years. She held leadership roles in the National TTT Society and International Questers Association. She was a founder of the Kingsley Mobile Meals Program and served as their treasurer for many years. She was also a member of the Residence Advocate Committee at the Kingsley Nursing and Rehab Center. Tommy R. Tanner, 40, of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, November 14. Services will be at 1 p.m. on Monday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel at 3220 Stone Park Boulevard in Sioux City. Burial will follow at Calvary Cemetery. Following burial, there will be a time of fellowship from 2:30 to 5:30 at Pease Pizza House in Dakota Dunes. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service on Monday at the funeral home. Tommy Ray Tanner, the son of Leonard Ray and Patricia Johnson Tanner, was born September 30, 1982, in Sioux City. Tommy grew up in Sioux City and graduated from North High in 2001. For the past 19 years, Tommy has worked at Kaiser Refrigeration in Sioux City. He started his career as a technician and for the past several years has worked in sales. On December 26, 2008, Tommy fell in love with his soulmate, Jean Kratz, and welcomed her son, Jevon, into his life. Tommy and Jevon shared many interests and activities together. Tommy was a major influence in helping to make Jevon the man he is today. Tommy and Jean shared many wonderful adventures together as they traveled to various vacation spots in the United States and around the world, creating lifetime memories. Tommy enjoyed tinkering in his garage, which included refurbishing gas pumps and working on vehicles for friends and family. He also enjoyed classic cars and truly loved spending time at Miner's Bend, where he would bowfish. Tommy will be remembered for his infectious laugh, smile, and being the life of the party. Anyone that knew Tommy would say he played hard, worked hard, and loved hard. Jason Ballweber Danbury, 50, died Monday, November 14. Celebration of Life will be November 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home, Mapleton, Iowa, in charge of arrangements. Kenneth V. Hoffman, 92, of Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, November 16. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Ken was born on August 4, 1930. He was the 12th child of John and Clara Beck Hoffman. Ken was baptized and confirmed at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. He began working at Kootahay Packing until he was drafted into the Army in 1950. He served in the 2nd Infantry Division, 38th Regiment, from 1951 to 1952. In Korea, he rose to the rank of Staff Sergeant as he led patrols in the Punchbowl region and was part of three major offensives. After an honorable discharge, Ken attended Radio and TV Repair School in Kansas City. He owned and operated a repair shop on Court Street in Sioux City while working at Zenith. On July 1, 1962, Ken married Cheryl Cook. They made a home in the Morningside area of Sioux City and raised two children, Beth Barta and Rob Hoffman. After the closure of Zenith, he worked several skilled labor positions. He worked at Needham Packing Plant and Dynatech, where he wired standby generators. In 1976, Ken started Sioux City Precision Grinding, where he sharpened tools for local manufacturing facilities. In 1982, Ken was the head maintenance technician for the United Federal Building until he was hired on at Rochester Products until his retirement in 1993. Ken enjoyed working with his hands, whether it was to provide for his family or as a hobby. He built model airplanes, tended his many flower gardens, and worked in his wood shop. He was an active member of St. Paul's Lutheran, and in 2006, he and Cheryl transferred to Bethany Lutheran, where he was actively involved in a variety of projects. Ken openly shared his faith in Jesus Christ and wanted to tell everyone, "I'm not here, I've gone home." Janet Jean Wig, 72, of South Sioux City, Nebraska, passed away on Thursday, November 17, at a local hospital. Services will be at 2 p.m. on Tuesday at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home, with Pastor John Woodford of Good News Baptist Church officiating. Burial will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery in Sioux City. Visitation with family present will be from noon on Tuesday until time of the service. Janet was born on June 24, 1950, in Sioux City, to Eugene and Bernadine Connell McClure. Janet was a spunky, funny, and loving person. She had three children, Kimmy, Michael, and Lita, and was an amazing Nana to her 14 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren, which she loved so much. She married Paul Wig on July 26, 1985, on the river by Elk Point, South Dakota. Janet worked in a few different professions, but retired from Peck Optical Corporation, where she manufactured eyewear. She enjoyed shopping, fishing, and traveling, and we can't forget how she loved her dog. She was a person who lit up a room and was the life of the party. She will be forever missed. Aaron Thomas Journey, 51, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, November 5th, after a brief bout with an aggressive, inoperable esophageal cancer that spread rapidly. There will be a celebration of life from 2 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, December 3rd, at Lago Mar Clubhouse in Lamarck, Texas. A celebration of life will be held in Sioux City in the spring. Aaron was born in Santa Rosa, California on September 1st, 1971. Aaron held a triple major with a BA in psychology, was an avid musician, playing bass with Ghost Ship for 10 years, as well as many other bands. Aaron was most recently working as an independent insurance adjuster. Aaron had numerous friends throughout the country and will be greatly missed. Larry Heineman, 74, of Murphy, North Carolina, formerly from Sioux City, passed away Wednesday, November 16, in a Chattanooga, Tennessee hospital. Celebration of life will be held in Sioux City at a later date. Ivy Funeral Home Murphy is in charge of arrangements. Larry was a native of Sioux City, where he lived until moving to Murphy in 2002. He was a Vietnam veteran who served in the United States Army, being stationed in Vietnam throughout his service. Larry began his career with Sioux Tools on September 14, 1970, working as a machinist. He was transferred to Murphy in 2002 to the local Sioux Tools, now Snap-on Tools, where he retired June 30, 2021 as a quality control engineer. Larry enjoyed the outdoors, specifically golfing, hunting, fishing, and camping. He loved gardening and produced one of his best gardens this past summer. He was the son of the late Robert Carl and Alice Myers Heineman. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made in honor of Larry Heineman to the Honor Flight, Box L4016, Columbus, Ohio, 43260, or www.honorflight.org/donations.html. Jody K. Phillips passed away peacefully on Sunday, November 13, in Boulder at the age of 95. There will be a private burial service for Jody and Jim in Sioux City at a later date. Jody was born and raised in Sioux City. She graduated from Central High School's and Mills College in Oakland, California, where she met her future husband while he was a student at Stanford U. She taught school in San Mateo, California, while Jim was getting a degree at Princeton. They married in 1951. After living in California and Venezuela, they moved back to Sioux City. In 1969, she helped her husband start a new business, which was then called Phillips Kiln Service Company. After 19 years, they retired to their summer home on Crandall's Beach in Spirit Lake and spent winters in Florida. In 2013, they moved to Boulder, where they lived with their son, Carrie Michael, and his wife, Sharon, for 3 years. After Jim's death, Jody moved to her own home in Boulder. Jody was a member of Portfolio Book Study Club, a former member of Sioux City Junior League, and the First Presbyterian Church of Spirit Lake. Her brother, father, uncle, and grandfather were at one time prominent Sioux City attorneys. Deborah Ray Reichel, Lamars, Iowa, 57, died Friday, November 18. Services will be November 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Maura Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. Burial will be at a later date at the Memorial Cemetery, Lamars. Visitation will be November 23rd from 12 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. Avanel Ava Sargent, Akron, Iowa, 92, died Wednesday, November 16. Burial will be a private family burial at Riverside Cemetery in Akron. Visitation will be November 26 from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Akron. And that concludes the obituaries. We'll move on to a couple of other short stories. Northwestern College to present Christmas Vespers, Orange City. The Northwestern College Music Department will present its annual Christmas Vespers concert at 7 p.m. December 3rd and 3 p.m. December 4th in Christ Chapel 10, 1 7th Street Southwest in Orange City. The theme for this year's concerts will be In the Footsteps of Mary. The performances will feature narration by recently retired theater professors Jeff and Karen Barker. It will explore the Christmas story from Mary's perspective, from the announcement of the Incarnation to the foreshadowing of the cross. Guest soloist Michelle Monroe, mezzo-soprano, will sing the role of Mary in the five-movement setting of Magnificat by Emmett Reminisch, joined by the a cappella choir and accompanist Nora Verberg. In addition to the a cappella choir, Northwestern's Women Choir, Orchestra, Brass Ensemble, and organist Mary Lou Rilinga will also perform. The program will also feature select seasonal pieces such as Mary Did You Know, Lo How a Rose, and Bach's My Spirit Be Joyful, among others. According to music professor Dr. Thomas Holm, the Vesper concerts will engage listeners with all the elements of Mary's life journey. From beginning to end, these performances will feature a variety of high-quality music, leading the audience through a narrative that includes many aspects of the Christmas story, he said. The audience will also be invited to join in singing traditional Christmas carols during this event that is free and open to the public. And then country singer coming to Encounter Center, Sioux City. Country singer Greg Hager will present a musical journey highlighting Midwestern living on stage at 2 p.m. November 27 at the Betty Strong Encounter Center, 900 Larson Park Road. Hager is a storyteller who uses his original songs about life, living love, cattle, country, and faith to weave a journey for every audience. He has recorded 9 CDs in Nashville, including ones featuring Western love songs, a Christmas album, and 2 country gospel albums. The Betty Strong Encounter Center and the adjoining Sioux City Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center comprise a private, nonprofit culture complex and sustained by Missouri River Historical Development, Inc. We'll now move to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my husband passed away 2 years ago. I hope you can give me some advice on how to deal with my 53-year-old daughter who never left home. We generally get along. She does freelance art, but doesn't earn much. She contributes only $30 a month. Also, she has a driving phobia, so she doesn't drive. She expects me to drive her to various places. She only has cyber friends. She wants to travel, but doesn't want to go alone, and keeps pushing me to go with her, although I don't really want to. I have suggested group tours, but she hesitates to go alone. I feel pressured to keep peace and go along with her desires. How should I handle this? Signed, Pulling Back in Nevada. Abby responds, you have protected and enabled your daughter for far too long. Tell her that her dependence on you has become too much. She must overcome her driving phobia, or at least take advantage of public transportation, and her fear of travel without you. Unless you have provided for her financially in the event of your death, how do you think she will survive living as a virtual shut-in with no employment and life skills? There are psychotherapists who specialize in ridding people of phobias. While she's there, your daughter should also get help to gain a degree of independence, even if it's about 30 years too late. Dear Abby, recently my 3 adult children chipped in to send their aunt dinner for her birthday. She's 79 and doesn't need anything. She doesn't even go out. Financially, she's in good shape. They placed the order and it came to $95. Well, Abby, my elderly mom went crazy. She thought that was too little to spend on their aunt. I think my kids were very thoughtful. They are all trying to build their lives. One has 2 kids, a house, and a mortgage. The other just got engaged and is saving for the wedding. The third is saving for her future. My mother thinks her grandchildren should give her gifts and money. I think she should expect money from her own kids, not the grandkids. I hung up on her when she attacked my children. She always thinks she's right. Your thoughts? Signed, Living with a Difficult Mom. Abby's response. Was Auntie satisfied with the meal? Your mother may think she is always right, but she was wrong to criticize the amount your children spent on dinner for their aunt. That she would then announce she expects gifts and money from them is beyond presumptuous. The decision about what to give is up to the giver, not the recipient. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, November 20th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. You can access a recording of today's reading on the website iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.